giving up most of her responsibilities at the public affairs shop Dewey Square Group to move into an office in Brooklyn with a sign on the door that said, Super Volunteer. Possessed of a steel spine, Moore served as a fixer in the Super Six meetings, determined to reduce the number of problems that rose to Hillary's level, and as a mentor for many of the mid- and junior-level staffers. What she soon discovered after settling into the headquarters was that Mook's underlings were afraid that he would retaliate against them when they raised red flags. Everybody was on these eggshells, said one person familiar with the environment when Moore showed up. She became a spindle to break down silos and encouraged staffers to say what they wanted to say in front of Robbie or in front of John. There just needed to be a forum where stuff was actually hashed out instead of unilateral decision-making, said another person familiar with Hillary's thinking in putting together the Super Six. Moore was also a specialist in African-American outreach and the only black person at the top of a leadership team running a campaign that was relying on African-American voters to win the primary and needed them to show up in force in the general election. Most important, she was the one who best understood Hillary's history, motivations, and moods, and how they fit into the turbulent political environs of the 2016 campaign. Behind the scenes, Moore had helped Hillary lay the groundwork for this bid for years, going over the 2008 campaign's autopsy, helping her build her team at the State Department, and presenting, along with her Dewey Square Group colleagues, the blueprints for the current campaign years before the election. And it was Moore who was beckoned to the trail after New Hampshire to help Hillary get her arms around why the campaign wasn't working. At a slightly lower level, though, Marshall was consolidating power over state-by-state operations. Political director Amanda Renteria was stripped of her staff, and they were reassigned to Marshall's organizing team. Mook and Marshall would remain in control of the campaign's fieldwork. Mook also retained power over the all-important analytics team and paid media operations. There was good reason, aside from his skills, for Hillary to keep Mook happy enough. His ability to create a cult-like following within a campaign meant that he could boost morale or kill it. Hillary didn't have the luxury of sparing enthusiasm in her Brooklyn headquarters or anywhere else. The Super Six model, with Moore operating as eyes and ears for Hillary, was supposed to help get everyone on the same page so that decisions could be made and carried out efficiently. But the power struggles and ambiguity in the lines of authority within the campaign would persist. All of it reflected several truths about Hillary's world. First, she was ultimately running it. Second, she liked to set up rival power centers within and outside her operation, which created no shortage of confusion, angst, and infighting. And third, the campaign was just one piece of a much larger Clinton world operation that included the Clinton Foundation, Bill's personal office, and the legal team that had been assembled to handle her email issue. She was the only one with full visibility into all the component parts. Having cut off Bernie's chances of staging a comeback, and with her new power structure moving into place, Hillary began to think seriously about the major challenges of the general election. Deep in the shadows of Brooklyn, Podesta was working on a secret project. A few days before the March 15th primaries, he put together a list of potential vice presidential running mates for Hillary. His initial cut was shared with Cheryl Mills, the longtime Hillary confidant who had no formal role on the campaign and yet continued to exercise tremendous influence with the candidate and her top aides. Having worked with Podesta, Aberdeen, Moore, and Palmieri as far back as the Clinton White House days, and closely with Sullivan at State, she didn't need to be in the Super Six to know what was going on in Brooklyn. Podesta's first list included 36 names. They were broken into 7 categories: Latinos, female senators, male senators, African Americans, high-ranking military officials, business leaders, and Bernie Sanders. As Hillary was putting away the mini Super Tuesday states, Podesta and Mills made edits with Sullivan, Abedin, Palmieri, and Mook. The final version added New Yorkers Mike Bloomberg and Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, and Coca-Cola CEO Muhtar Kent, whose company was a multi-million dollar contributor to the Clinton Foundation. Michael Bennett of Colorado, a young swing state senator close to Obama but not to Hillary, was also added. Kevin De Leon, a leader in the California Assembly, was dropped. Podesta waited until 2 days after the March 15th primaries to send the list to Hillary, a tacit acknowledgement that the state of the race had turned inarguably in her favor. "Okay, I can breathe again. Congrats on a fabulous night," he wrote on March 17th. "I am feeling like it's possible to get back to the longer term again." He also sent her the names of people who would write reports on each of the prospective running mates and a separate team of vetters who would dive deeply into the candidates' backgrounds. "Let me know if there are people you would like to see added or removed before we begin the process," he concluded. Donald Trump was edging ever closer to the Republican nomination. The GOP race had, surprisingly, managed to get uglier over time, with Trump and Marco Rubio engaging in repartee about the sizes of each other's body parts, and Trump retweeting an unflattering picture of Ted Cruz's wife and eventually repeating a never-substantiated National Enquirer claim that the Texas senator had been unfaithful to her with a series of female aides and acquaintances. Bill thought Trump was crazy, but he had never expected the developer to become unhinged. He'd watched some of the debates and read the news coverage. Trump's attacks on Hispanics, Muslims, even Fox anchor Megyn Kelly were beyond the pale. But at that point, he welcomed Trump's success because he had long believed either Rubio or Cruz would make a tougher general election opponent for Hillary. Keeping one eye on the field, Bill saw Rubio as fresh and polished at the same time. His Cuban heritage would give him an opportunity to court the Hispanic voters that Trump was turning off with his plan to build a wall between the United States and Mexico and with his divisive rhetoric. Now, though, Rubio was out. Cruz, also of Hispanic heritage, would present a different kind of challenge to Hillary, but a strong one nonetheless. Bill wasn't sure how Trump would flip-flop if he were nominated, but he was confident that the Queens-reared billionaire wouldn't stick to the conservative line he was towing to get through the primary. Cruz, on the other hand, was a true believer with a vision that could be articulated. He could tap into the same anger that Trump was galvanizing on the political right and among fed-up independents. If elected, Bill thought, Cruz would try to make good on his promises to close down the IRS and other government agencies. As Trump closed in on the nomination, he focused ever more of his fire on Hillary. And in addition to the bedwetting within the Democratic Party, Hillary had to contend with the concerns of Democrats who had conflicting interests in individual states. Some wanted to keep their distance from her campaign, and others had specific needs that threatened to hurt her turnout. From Hillary's point of view, she could no longer afford to take incoming fire from Bernie. It was time for him to start winding down his campaign. The mini Super Tuesday states had been an inflection point. Bernie's camp was slower to come to grips with that. But over time, his camp would divide over when and how to ramp down. For now, Bernie, his wife Jane, and campaign manager Jeff Weaver knew he could capture several upcoming states and hoped, hoped enough to believe that he could grab momentum, score a couple of upsets at the end of the primary, and convince superdelegates to abandon Clinton and put him over the top. It was not lost on them that there was a startling irony in Hillary, who had run through 50 states against Obama, wanting Bernie to cease and desist. That is, Bernie and the people closest to him wanted to rage against the dying of the light. And rage Bernie did. He won 7 of 8 states between March 22nd and April 9th, including blowouts in Washington, Utah, and Wisconsin. During that time, he ramped up his attacks on Clinton, particularly her ill-advised decision to give paid speeches to companies with business before the federal government. For a time, it sounded like Sanders believed his opponent wasn't Hillary Clinton, but some guy named Goldman Sachs. Though Sanders had refused assistance offered from the Democratic National Committee, he accused the party machine and its chairwoman, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, of tilting the playing field in Hillary's favor. It wasn't a baseless charge. Hillary's campaign had been in close communication with Wasserman Schultz throughout, and it reinforced the idea that she was a candidate born of the establishment at a time when voters in both parties were as angry as they had been in generations with the nation's major institutions. Bernie was taking a family fight to new levels. In so many words, he kept calling her corrupt. It was one thing to hit her on policy, but his increasingly favored brand of personal attacks would deepen some Democrats' distrust of her and could easily spill over into the general election. It was terribly damaging to have a fellow Democrat, or at least someone running for the party's nomination, highlight the very weaknesses most voters already saw in her. Moreover, Hillary thought it was unfair. She'd ignored warnings from friends not to give the paid speeches, but she truly believed she couldn't be corrupted and that she hadn't done anyone favors for money. Her platform, she thought, was proof positive that she would regulate big banks, and she had promised to make it easier to prosecute wrongdoing at a time when liberals believed the Obama administration had gone too easy on bankers in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. The whole bought and paid for thing came from Bernie, one Clinton aide said in the fall of 2016, lamenting that it hadn't really been a knock against her among Democrats coming into the campaign. That did her damage. Her overall national favorability rating had actually held fairly constant in the low 40s, a sign that most Democrats still approved of her. But it had slowly moved downward, while her unfavorability percentage had moved from below 50 in mid-December 2015 to the mid-50s by early April 2016. The idea that she was in the pocket of big banks bothered her, said another staffer, who nonetheless maintained that it was a horrible mistake to give the speeches in the first place. But, as with the email scandal and the dealings of the Clinton Foundation, she couldn't turn back the clock. She could only pledge to be a strict regulator and hope that Bernie would back off. Democrats worried that Bernie would just keep turning the knife in a vain effort to win the nomination by destroying her. Ironically, Hillary had made changes in her campaign just in time to lose a string of states that favored Sanders simply because they were caucuses, or allowed independents to vote in Democratic primaries, or had few voters of color, or some combination of those factors. And equally ironically, Bernie looked like he was gaining momentum when 5 nails had been driven into his campaign's coffin on March 15th. But because they could write off Bernie's wins as coming in states tailored to him, and because they were so hyper-focused on delegates, Hillary and her team didn't pay enough attention to the fact that working-class progressives, particularly the white ones, were voting against her at alarming rates. As Sanders reeled off a string of sizable victories, including a double-digit blowout in the white working-class haven of Wisconsin. Democratic allies continued to tell Hillary she wasn't putting enough money and energy into each of the states. On April 5th, for example, Bernie had beaten her 59% to 40% among white voters in Wisconsin. The numbers were a little bit more stark in the set of voters with household income between $50,000 and $100,000 per year, 60% to 39%. And gender continued to have a high correlation with her performance. Despite getting thrashed in the state, 57% to 43%, Hillary had edged Bernie 50% to 49% among women. But among men, he crushed her, 63% to 36%. The myopia was striking. Hillary had blinders on because she had always thought the primary would be tougher than the general election. Where she had misunderstood the importance of delegate accumulation in 2008, she was now so driven by math and the message that she would win by sheer numerical force that she couldn't or wouldn't see that she was doing nothing to inspire the poor, rural, and working-class white voters who had so identified with her husband. She was aware of the problem, but she didn't act effectively to fix it. After all, she was racking up delegates. Rather than vying for their votes, the campaign dismissed their impact in the primary. That attitude was evident in a memo Mook posted on Medium in early April. It was designed to point out to the press and the public that Sanders was no longer in contention for the nomination, an idea that, if it took hold, would start to build pressure on Bernie to either get out or simply stop attacking Clinton. But it was bloodless in its analysis. The math being what it is, the Sanders campaign has struggled to explain their path to the nomination, Mook wrote. Their latest strategy involves a combination of trying to flip pledged delegates at state and county conventions, while also convincing superdelegates that he deserves their support, despite the fact that Hillary Clinton has won 58% of the popular vote and a majority of pledged delegates thus far. He was basically making the delegate side argument that Hillary had been constructing against Sanders's policy. It was pure fantasy. That had everything to do with who was going to win, and it was a reasonable measure of which candidate voters had favored so far, but it was hardly an argument that her platform or her values were better than Bernie's. Bernie was just one of the problems Hillary faced in the spring, down the home stretch of the Democratic primary season. But he was still foremost on her mind after he thwacked her in Wisconsin. He only picked up 10 net delegates from the voting results. Even when Bernie won a state by a big margin, he couldn't count on substantially cutting into Hillary's lead. Her delegate hunting team was the most consistently effective part of her campaign. And, to her credit, the lesson she'd most fully learned from 2008 was to make sure her delegates were in line. To put a finer point on it, 9 of the 10 superdelegates in Wisconsin went to Hillary, meaning that his overall edge in the state was 49 delegates to 47 delegates, despite his overwhelming victory in the popular vote. For the data lovers in politics, this meant that the trajectory for him to win the nomination was even steeper than it had been before. Hillary was getting closer to winning even when she was losing, because there were states left on the map that she was sure to win big, and the window for Bernie to make a move closed with each passing primary day. The prospect of a long, slow march to an inevitable Clinton nomination frustrated Sanders and his supporters no end, and it made them much more aggressive. Bernie's attacks on Hillary's character and the Clintons' record, repeated by progressive activists, were dividing the Democratic Party and getting under Bill's skin. A few days after the Wisconsin primary, he got into a protracted battle with two Black Lives Matter protesters who interrupted him at a recreation center in Philadelphia. One held a sign with the word "super predator" on it, a reference to Hillary's mid-1990s remark about putting super predators away. They called her a murderer, too, for her role in the bombardment of Libya that eventually led to Muammar Gaddafi's death. Bill went back and forth with them for 10 minutes about his 1994 crime bill and a variety of other topics. I don't know how you would characterize the gang leaders who got 13-year-old kids hopped up on crack and sent them out into the street to murder other African-American children, he charged in reference to the super predator sign. Maybe you thought they were good citizens. She didn't. The tense confrontation, an echo of a private South Carolina event at which Hillary had been verbally accosted by a BLM protester, seemed way off message for a campaign reliant on support from African Americans and worried that younger Black voters were more likely than their older counterparts to support Bernie. Hillary had already apologized for her choice of words, and here Bill was defending his policy, his legacy, and her original sentiments. Bill thought he'd turned in effectively, countering the BLM protesters with context, history, and facts about the Clinton Foundation's work on behalf of Black lives in Africa. His answer was the right one for his old political frame, a throwback to his sister soldier moment, and for many working-class whites who neither saw themselves as racially insensitive nor had a problem with the super-predator description for gangbangers. He believed he was in the right and that he was helping his wife. No one else did. For many in Clinton world, it was a flashback to his clumsy handling of race issues in the 2008 campaign, a clue that he no longer had a pitch-perfect sense of the American electorate or the Democratic Party's values. As his small motorcade left the Dorothy Emanuel Recreation Center in a heavily African-American neighborhood and rolled through Northwest Philadelphia, Bill's aides lit into him. "Whether you're right or not," they told him, "you went about this the wrong way." His little campaign team, led by Chief of Staff Tina Flournoy, made no bones about telling him when he'd messed up. This had been his worst foul-up of the campaign, they told him. It was too late in the cycle, and they were too close to a string of May primaries in which Sanders was expected to do well, for Bill to still be shaking off rust. He had been in Philadelphia because polling showed that the upcoming April 26th Pennsylvania contest offered Sanders an opportunity to steal a big state from underneath Hillary's feet. Afterward, the campaign essentially sided with the protesters, reiterating that Hillary should have picked different terms to describe gangsters. The feeling inside the campaign was that Bill had helped Bernie in a state where African-American turnout and support were key to Hillary holding off the surge. He was going to have to stay focused. Before Pennsylvania, though, Hillary and Bernie would sprint to the finish line in New York on April 19th. On paper, it was a home game for Hillary, who had been elected statewide there twice. But Brooklyn-born Bernie had a claim on the state, too, and he and his aides began to portray it as a last chance for him to turn the race around. He was going to fight her and fight hard on her own turf. Damaging Hillary in her backyard would not only signal her weakness in the primary, but ingrain the narrative that he was the stronger general election candidate versus an opponent like Trump. If Bill was feeling frustrated with Bernie's attacks, Hillary was feeling worse. She wanted to go negative. She was the one who had been absorbing his ever-heightening broadsides, and she was pissed that the news media always portrayed him as running a positive campaign on the issues. Bullshit, she thought. Bernie's entire campaign was a character assassination, a moral high ground argument that she was less pure than he was. Of course, that was true in the sense that she believed in moving forward by building political coalitions. Bernie didn't work with anyone. He didn't do it in the House. He didn't do it in the Senate. His coalition on the campaign trail was almost entirely white and disproportionately male. Hell, he was only competitive in states where just a handful of people showed up for caucuses, or large portions of the electorate were independents, not Democrats. His platform was fantastical, and it wasn't nearly as well thought out as hers. Unlike Obama, whom she'd painted that way in 2008, Bernie really didn't make any effort to explain realistic scenarios in which his agenda could be enacted. Obama worried about the costs of his proposals and their real-world impact. Bernie relied on rhetoric about a political revolution, that even electing him president would only be the beginning. His followers would have to rise up and remake the entire political map over a series of elections, convincing America of the rightness and rectitude of his brand of socialism. After stepping up the attacks and creating an unforgettable narrative about Hillary's lack of integrity, Sanders framed her to his supporters as the problem, not the solution. She would never be for them because she was nothing like them. For the most part, Hillary and her campaign aides were fearful that attacks on Bernie would just backfire. But New York was different. These voters were accustomed to bare-knuckle politics. She had better standing with them, and there were issues, Israel, for example, on which they were much more aligned with her than with Bernie. On conference calls, she and her aides talked about getting a little tougher with him. On the other side, Bernie and his top strategist, Tad Devine, split over how to approach New York. Devine wanted to run a campaign in the state that focused on Bernie's roots there. He would out New York the New Yorker. Devine even cut an ad, narrated by Susan Sarandon, that focused on Bernie's Brooklyn upbringing. But Bernie and Jane Sanders weren't sold on the risk of sacrificing his national brand to sell himself in the state. Devine thought New York was make or break. But they all agreed that it was time to turn up the heat even more on Hillary. "We were really going to get much more aggressive about her weakness as a candidate," said one Bernie ally. Every single time Bernie ridiculed Clinton's six-figure speeches, "Not a bad day's work," he would say, "and her ties to Wall Street," he planted doubt in the minds of even the staunchest Democrats. His thinly veiled allegations of corruption, coupled with the unrelenting crush of the still-unfolding email scandal, kept the pressure on her. And Trump did his part to reinforce Sanders's message, debuting the nickname Crooked Hillary at a rally in Watertown, New York, just before voters went to the polls. An athlete hasn't proved his mettle until he has survived New York sports fans. It's the same in politics, and Bernie wasn't ready for the playoff-style atmosphere in the Big Apple. He choked. The first hands around his throat belonged to Art Brown, the top dog in his meeting with the editorial board of the New York Daily News. Brown, a slim, balding, Pulitzer Prize winner with about 40 years logged at the paper, tried to nail him down on a basic question that had eluded most of the media for the entirety of the campaign. Bernie liked to say that he would break up the big banks. In the interview, Sanders acknowledged two important substantive matters that undermined his favorite talking point. He didn't have a plan for what to do with the banks once they were broken up, and there was already existing authority under the Dodd-Frank law to wind down banks that posed too much risk to the system. He was calling for new authority that already existed. And beyond that, he couldn't say what would happen to all of the assets once a bank was required to break apart. He was flirting with increasing the risk to consumers rather than decreasing it. It was a demonstration of exactly what Hillary had been saying about him. His plans weren't real. That is their decision as to what they want to do and how they want to reconfigure themselves, he said. That's not my decision. All I am saying is that I do not want to see this country be in a position where it was in 2008, where we have to bail them out. And in addition, I oppose that kind of concentration of ownership entirely. On his number one issue, he sounded lost on the specifics. Hillary seized the opening immediately, using an appearance on Morning Joe the following day to pounce. Well, I think he hadn't done his homework, and he'd been talking for more than a year about doing things that he obviously hadn't really studied or understood, and that does raise a lot of questions, she said. Asked whether he was qualified for the presidency, she demurred. Bernie was furious. He hadn't gone so far as to say she was unqualified, and to him, she'd done just that to him. He thought he needed to throw a roundhouse, and he overswung at a campaign rally later that day. Clinton said, "I am, quote, unquote, not qualified to be president," Sanders told the crowd. She'd never said it that way. Maybe he'd been misinformed by a staffer, but it was untrue. Honest Bernie was lying about dishonest Hillary. Then he went on. I don't believe that she is qualified if she is, through her super PAC, taking tens of millions of dollars in special interest funds. He sounded out of control. The touchstone for Hillary's approach to wailing on Sanders was a bank shot ad she began running in New York about a week before the primary that hit both Bernie and Trump. It showed clips of Trump's most outlandish statements. Women should be punished for having abortions. Mexico sends the United States its rapists, and Muslims should be banned from entering the country, to contrast Hillary's values with those of the likely Republican nominee. At the end, an announcer proclaims, "She's the one tough enough to stop Trump." Trump was emerging as the frontrunner, and it was a way for us to put our flag down and reiterate what was at stake, one aide said. In her telling, Trump was the enemy of all Democrats, and Bernie was the candidate too frail to fight him. The title of the ad, Stronger Together. Bernie had played right into her hands when the heat had been turned up on him. He did more of his own damage than we really did on him, said one top Hillary aide. That was his worst couple of weeks, but it was really self-inflicted. Hillary ended up whipping Bernie 58% to 42%, even as his massive, enthusiastic crowds dwarfed her much smaller and more sedate campaign events. That was kind of our last hurrah in terms of actually trying to win the thing, said one Bernie advisor. After that, it was a question of how much ground we were going to capture between that and the end of the primary season. But Bernie didn't see it quite that way. While he always knew he was a long shot to win, his drubbing in New York didn't dissuade him from campaigning hard. He was a better candidate than Hillary, he believed, and there was still a chance to convince Democratic superdelegates of that. If he could just keep it close and win a big state like California, maybe, just maybe, others would see the flaws in Hillary that were so obvious to him and to Trump. Besides, even if he couldn't supplant Hillary, each additional delegate he won would give him more leverage in negotiating the Democratic platform, he thought. Hillary and her team believed New York had finally and conclusively ended the competitive phase of the primary. For the fourth time, one aide joked with a sigh. Whether the press would give her the title or not, Hillary now knew she was the presumptive Democratic nominee, and she expected the trappings of that standing. It was time to force fellow Democrats to declare their allegiance and help her put Bernie away once and for all. Her state of mind was evident to those around her during a visit to Maryland in advance of the April 26th primary there. Representative Chris Van Hollen, who had scored a maximum 7 on a hit list of enemies she'd kept after the 2008 campaign, was locked in a tough Senate primary fight with Representative Donna Edwards. Van Hollen, the choice of Senate Democratic leaders Harry Reid and Chuck Schumer, worried throughout the campaign that Hillary's ability to turn out black voters in Maryland could put Edwards, who is black, over the top. He had support from some major unions, and at a rally in Baltimore, Hillary learned that those unions planned to help Van Hollen by not pushing black labor voters out to the polls. If their members voted in force, many of them would pull the lever for Edwards. Rather than directly suppressing the black vote, which could be lethal in a Democratic primary, Van Hollen banked on his union allies just going through the motions. Hillary was outraged. She wanted to win Maryland and win it big. She needed to show Sanders just how futile his efforts were at a time when he still hadn't given up the ghost of defeating her and was now responding to her with the indignation of a candidate who had been humiliated in his native state of New York. She was also feeling entitled to the kind of fealty typically accorded the party's nominee for president. As an aide walked her out of the event, Hillary smiled and waved at a crowd of supporters, but her broad grin belied the anger behind it. Through bared and gritted teeth, vengeance slipped out. "Who gives a fuck about Chris Van Hollen?" she said to her aide. "What the fuck are we going to do to fix this?" The aide said he would deliver a message to the unions. "Do you want another friend in the Senate, or do you want one in the White House?" The threat was pretty explicit. Hillary, who kept careful track of friends and enemies, wouldn't look kindly on anything less than a full-throttle effort to drive black voters to the polls in Maryland. "Good," she said to the aide. "I'm not going to let his campaign suppress the vote in Baltimore." All the while, she kept smiling and waving. On the verge of capturing the Democratic nomination, Hillary was sick of other people's priorities getting in the way of her path to the presidency. In the end, the unions did enough to appease Hillary without jeopardizing Van Hollen. "They really did the bare minimum," said one political observer familiar with the state's labor politics. Hillary cruised to victory anyway in Maryland and won 3 other states on April 26th. But the fact that she'd had to push unions to whip up their members to vote was indicative of how little natural support she had in the ranks. The lack of enthusiasm for her candidacy among labor's foot soldiers in Maryland should have been one of that day's major warning signs. She also lost Rhode Island, a haven for working-class whites. But the outcome there was overshadowed by Hillary's victories in more populous states, including Pennsylvania. It was high time, Hillary believed, for Bernie to back off. A few days later, at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, a black-tie affair for the president, the White House press corps, Washington's self-important political class, and a smattering of Hollywood elites, Hillary ad maker Jim Margolis bumped into Devine. They'd known each other for more than 3 decades, having both worked for 1984 Democratic presidential nominee Walter Mondale. Margolis pulled Devine aside. Bernie was hurting Hillary with his emphasis on her ties to the banking industry. "One ad in particular was really excruciating," he said. "Can you please stop running the Goldman Sachs ad?" Margolis asked. The spot came down. Chapter 13. Too Easy. As Donald Trump took control of the Republican race, one of Hillary's longtime advisors circulated a memo. The very top read, "Fact, Donald Trump can defeat Hillary Clinton and become the 45th president of the United States." Hillary, the memo went on to say, should not underestimate his capacity to draw people to the polls who normally do not vote. That could tip the scales in key states and put certain states in play that would otherwise be more safely Democratic, the advisor wrote, adding that in assessing polls, I'd routinely add 3 or 4 points to whatever they say about his support. For a Brooklyn command that worshipped hard data, such musings were the kind of misguided, old-school hocus-pocus that had very little to do with winning modern campaigns. So perhaps it shouldn't have been surprising that the advisor's memo never gained traction. This campaign engine, driven so much by the science of analytics and so little by the art of political persuasion, was really starting to hum. Mook had tuned out his internal and external critics, focused on the numerical path to victory, and now it had paid off. Hillary was poised to become the first woman ever nominated for president by a major political party. Better yet, she was going to draw Trump, the clown prince of the Republican primary field, as a general election opponent. Soon the increasingly popular Barack Obama would join her on the campaign trail and bless her as the natural heir to his historic presidency. These young data warriors, most of whom had grown up in politics during the Obama era, behaved as though the Democratic Party had come up with an inviolable formula for winning presidential elections. It started with the blue wall, 18 states plus the District of Columbia that had voted for the Democratic presidential nominee in every election since 1992. They accounted for 242 of the 270 electoral votes needed to win the presidency. From there, you expanded the playing field of battleground states to provide as many paths as possible to get the remaining 28 electoral votes. Adding to their perceived advantage, Democrats believed they demonstrated in Obama's 2 elections that they were much more sophisticated in bringing data to bear to get their voters to the polls. For all the talk of models and algorithms, the basic thrust of campaign analytics was pretty straightforward when it came to figuring out how to move more voters to the polls. The data team would collect as much information as possible about potential voters, including age, race, ethnicity, voting history, and magazine subscriptions, among other things. Each person was given a score, ranging from 0 to 100, in each of 3 categories. Probability of voting, probability of voting for Hillary, and probability, if they were undecided, that they could be persuaded to vote for her. These scores determined which voters got contacted by the campaign and in which manner. A television spot, an ad on their favorite website, a knock on their door, or a piece of direct mail. It's a grayscale, said a campaign aide familiar with the operation. You start with the people who are the best targets and go down until you run out of resources. Mook, always attentive to cash flow, knew that it was much more costly to try to persuade undecided voters to back Hillary than it was to register her supporters or to make sure they went to the polls. The analytics team could also conduct less expensive surveys than the pollsters to get a snapshot of the horse race in a given state. Separate from the 3 scores, the analytics experts would do quick surveys with a small universe of voters and then extrapolate how many other voters with similar demographic profiles were likely to vote and for whom they would cast their ballots. The same methods had been used in the primaries, when adjustments could be made based on the outcome of a string of contests. The general election was different, in part, because there was only 1 election day. The analytics were also thought to be more precise at predicting general election outcomes in each state than primary outcomes, because the exact shape of the electorate could be harder to project in lower turnout contests. But in both cases, Mook relied heavily on the data to figure out where the campaign could get the most bang for its buck. Like a baseball executive in the Moneyball era, Mook looked at the data as the means for taking the least costly route to victory. Every investment decision we made, like how many staff to put into a state, how frequently she would visit someplace, was all driven by analytics, said one high-ranking campaign official. Mook had taken a lot of incoming fire for those decisions from insiders and outsiders who believed he'd relied too heavily on the data to slice and dice the electorate, rather than reaching out beyond those most likely to vote for Hillary. Mook used analytics not as a tool but as a decider, said the high-ranking official, who wanted the campaign manager to rely less exclusively on analytics. Jen O'Malley Dillon, the runner-up for manager who worked with the campaign for many months, pushed Mook to spend more on persuading voters by knocking on their doors, a traditional method of building vote count. But the combination of a shorter-than-anticipated window for focusing on the general election, because of the length of the primaries, and the relative cost of on-the-ground persuasion efforts pulled Mook in a different direction. He chose to focus on turning out voters who already preferred Hillary with his staff in the states, and on using television and digital advertising to change hearts and minds. We did not have the choice to take a path off the table, said one person who disagreed with Mook's approach. It wasn't enough to say that we could just do voter registration and turnout and that would be enough to win. And I never believed that advertising and digital alone is enough to do your persuasion. Mook quieted the dissenters and moved forward with his plan. But he had plenty of defenders, too. That team really helped drive the campaign, which is how it should work, said one ally. It ends up being right more than it's wrong. By the tail end of the primary calendar, he had reason to believe his methods had been validated. Hillary had racked up the delegates she needed to capture the nomination. She hadn't really been surprised anywhere but Michigan, and her bank account had never been empty. The success emboldened him. Between the built-in advantage her campaign team believed Democrats had in the Electoral College, the data squad's ability to target voters in such a sophisticated fashion, and the Republicans' impending nomination of Trump, Mook began to think about expanding the electoral battleground into traditionally Republican states. Toward the end of the primary, he would commission the data analytics team to conduct surveys, not just in battleground states, but in traditionally Democratic places like Washington and Oregon, and the Republican strongholds of Arizona, Georgia, and Texas, so that he could get a feel for just how much he might try to flex Democratic muscles across the map. The analytics surveys were quicker and cheaper than traditional polling, and in Mook's view, they were just as accurate about candidate preference. At the same time, Trump was taking the opposite tack. Instead of trying to increase the number of competitive states, he concentrated intently on a handful that carried large numbers of electoral votes. Trump focused in particular on Rust Belt states Obama won, where his tough-talking Queens bravado and isolationist message played well with working-class whites, and Florida, where Obama had prevailed by less than 1 percentage point in 2012. Together, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Florida accounted for 93 electoral votes. If Trump won any 4 of the 5 and held on to Romney's states, he would be president. In some scenarios, he only needed 3 of them. And of all the states that Romney had won, Obama had only come within 5 percentage points in 1, North Carolina. There was good reason for Trump to have some hope. He had several important tailwinds. Only twice since 1828 had a Democrat won a 3rd consecutive term for the party. Populist movements on the right and the left had arisen from the ashes of the 2008 financial crisis and gathered steam throughout the intervening years. And the states he needed to flip had all elected Republican governors. By early May, Trump was galvanizing the GOP and rising in head-to-head polls against Hillary. More worrisome for some Democrats, The plain talking Trump was striking a chord with working class white voters who felt like they had been left behind. With the exceptions of Ohio, where favorite son Governor John Kasich won, and Wisconsin, where Ted Cruz was the victor, Trump had carried all of the Rust Belt and Appalachia in the primaries. He's tapped into the real and understandable frustration that's felt among working people, AFL-CIO Chief Richard Trumka said that month. Once Cruz and Kasich dropped out of the race following the Indiana primary on May 3rd, Trump's inner circle, including campaign manager Corey Lewandowski and convention chairman Paul Manafort, visited the belly of the establishment beast, the headquarters of the Republican National Committee in Washington. His aides huddled with party officials for a day-long series of meetings that amounted to a 101 class on the party machinery. There, in the Ronald Reagan room, with TV monitors affixed to three of the four walls, RNC officials taught the rookies on Trump's team about budgets, data, strategy, messaging, and other aspects of the campaign. Some wrote on the room's whiteboard walls, leaving their scrawls visible during the next department's presentation. Trump's team was particularly enthralled with the communications presentation that focused on the RNC's strategy for hammering Hillary. Raj Shah, the party's research director, outlined the buckets of messaging against Clinton, a creature of Washington, a corrupt insider influenced by foreigners, untrustworthy, unaccomplished at state, and a liberal Democrat after 8 years of the liberal Democratic Obama presidency. Our goal was to make sure that we made them understand the contrast we could draw, one GOP source said. He would be the agent of change, and she would be the status quo. From the RNC's perspective, Hillary was a godsend. Everyone in the country knew the former First Lady, and the majority of Americans didn't trust or like her. The primary had only served to deepen voters' antipathy toward her. Half of the messaging job for Trump and the RNC was already done. With Hillary, the beauty was she was already defined, and we just needed to reinforce it, the official said. The challenge, even at that early date, was figuring out how to create the drip, drip, drip to reinforce the existing narrative. RNC officials had been surprised when polling in 2015 had shown that voters didn't care nearly as much that Hillary would be the first female president as they had in 2008 that Barack Obama would be the first black president. Whether that was because voters were misogynistic or just didn't care for Hillary was irrelevant. It only mattered that Hillary's gender wasn't going to sweep her into the presidency. That said, they had also learned from early surveys that most voters didn't hold Bill's infidelity against Hillary. While Democrats were convinced they had the math and a strong enough candidate to win the presidency, Republicans saw that the mood of the country created a landscape that should have suited them well. Hillary was deeply unpopular and well-defined. She was running for the Democratic Party's third consecutive term, and there was little reason to think her gender would be an asset. But they knew Trump was his own worst enemy, and they had little faith that he could be contained. If Trump went on vacation for the next 6 months, one Republican official observed, he would be the next president of the United States. The RNC's strategy and communications team explained the messaging that had been taking shape during the primary and shared the party's polling with a Trump operation that didn't spend much time or money on surveying public opinion. At a time when Hillary was supposed to be cruising to her nomination while a mess of Republicans battled to bear their party's standard, the reality was that the GOP was instead getting the jump on her. Suddenly, Hillary couldn't afford to lose any time. For months, years even, she had been secretly outlining plans for the general election. She hadn't known for sure that she would face off against Trump, but as he gathered steam during the primaries, the campaign, the Democratic National Committee, and an assortment of political action committees supporting Hillary increasingly turned their attention away from the other Republican candidates and homed in on the billionaire. While she battled Bernie, Hillary had to keep up the public appearance that she wasn't looking past him to the general election. At the end of April, she could wait no longer. She instructed aides to begin filling out staff rosters for the big battleground states, moves that would show she was now focusing on how to win in November. "That's when we started feeling like we needed to put people on the ground," said one Hillary aide. "That would position her to take on Trump, but not so early that you look like you're taking the primary for granted." But for Mook and the data analysts, it was already too late to build the kind of ground forces required to knock on doors and persuade voters to back Hillary. TV was persuasion. Mail was largely persuasion, said one high-ranking aide. The place where we didn't have as much opportunity to do persuasion was more a function of the primary than a decision. The thing with the field operation, unlike a TV ad or a piece of mail, a field operation takes several weeks to build, and the people knocking on doors aren't staff. Many of Hillary's field organizers had cut their teeth on Obama's 2012 campaign, when he had been able to build his battleground field operation without worrying about a primary. But the window was much shorter this time around, precisely because Bernie had stayed in the race until the very end. The best way to fund organizing is through the state parties and coordinated campaigns, but that's not available until there's a presumptive nominee, said one person familiar with the campaign's field operations. It takes about 2 months to find and train talent for a state-coordinated campaign, which works on turnout up and down the ballot for the party. Obama had been able to begin that process much earlier. Mook didn't have the time or the cash to ramp up in the same way. Time was unequivocally a factor, this person said. But, contradicting those who said the length of the primary was the only reason, he acknowledged, there was a strategic decision to do more voter registration work in the summer and not persuasion. Persuasion would turn out to be a key factor in 2016, because there was a lot of volatility in the electorate. Many voters were up for grabs, and Mook's critics believed he was ignoring an essential piece of the puzzle for building Hillary's coalition. Whether persuasion would work with voters who already had a wealth of information and well-formed opinions about the former First Lady was another question, one that would be impossible to answer without an earnest attempt. But Hillary and her aides weren't heeding warnings from the electorate. The self-assuring nature of taking primaries, coupled with Hillary's belief that her younger generation of organizers and data scientists understood the math and mechanics of winning, prevailed over her doubts about strategy and tactics. It was as if victory hinged solely on painting by the numbers revealed through analytics. Fundamentally, she was misreading the mood of the voters. Trump was winning primaries because he was a torch-bearing outsider, ready to burn the nation's institutions to the ground. Bernie was offering the same thing on the Democratic side, and he had flown in from off the political radar screen to give Hillary fits. In January 2016, Democratic pollster Stan Greenberg, a former Clinton White House aide and sometime critic of both Clintons, had beseeched Podesta to open Hillary's eyes to the changing world around her. With Bernie and Republicans attacking her as an agent of the establishment and an avatar of the status quo, Greenberg argued, Hillary had to make political reform a central part of her campaign. With Trump and Cruz attacking crony capitalism, do not assume we own reform in the general election, he advised. With people struggling financially, They want to make sure government works for them, and they want to make sure taxpayers get their money's worth. That includes many base Democratic voters. Hillary was running in the wrong year to ignore the power of promises to rein in establishment excesses. But she would never put forward an ethics agenda. The rise of populism, and particularly right-wing populism, wasn't a phenomenon limited to American politics. Brits were locked in a tense battle between those who wanted to exit the European Union and those who wanted to remain. Populist figures with nationalistic tendencies, like Nigel Farage in Britain, Marine Le Pen in France, and Norbert Hofer in Austria, were on the rise across Europe. By ceding the reformer mantle to Sanders and to Trump, Hillary was dismissing a whole world's worth of evidence that she was running into the headwinds of history. If you look at the absolute collapse of the establishment of the Republican Party, the fact that we survived through our primary process was actually a minor miracle, one of her senior aides told friends in the spring of 2016. Instead of shifting, she was locking in a general election strategy based on the assumption that the 2016 electorate would look a lot like those of the previous two elections. Having defeated Bernie's surge, Hillary was reassured that the national political firmament would hold. Interestingly, both Bill and Hillary were paying attention to British politics. In 2015, when conservatives thrashed the Liberal Labour Party, Hillary confided in aides that former Prime Minister Tony Blair had predicted to her that the left would lose if it ran a base election. She appeared to worry about being drawn too far to the left. Rather than seeing the conservative takeover as an affirmation of nationalistic populism, Bill believed the push for Brexit and its eventual approval by voters showed a strong contempt for existing power structures that reflected the mood of the American electorate. "You guys are underestimating the significance of Brexit," he told Brooklyn and his own advisors over and over. He'd come to power by tapping into similar frustrations in 1992, convincing voters that a reasonably good economy was swirling down the drain and that he was the only guy who could fish it out and revive it. Bill had a better feel for the working stiff, whether American or British, than anyone else in Hillary's orbit. He knew that, and he felt like he was being heard, but he couldn't figure out why Hillary and her team weren't executing. He liked Mook enough and appreciated the explanations he'd get for why the campaign was pursuing particular tactics and not others. It was a familiar feeling. Throughout the primary, he'd report back from the field on what he was hearing at campaign events and from friends across the country. Mook's response was always a variation on the same analysis. The data run counter to your anecdotes. Bill liked data, but he believed it was insufficient. To him, politics wasn't just about finding people who agreed with you and getting them to the polls. He felt that it was important to talk to voters individually and get a real sense for what they were feeling. He also believed that a candidate could persuade voters with the right argument. And in pursuit of that, the on-the-ground feel for how hopes and fears were motivating voters was invaluable. For Mook and the Brooklyn number crunchers, it held little value. Hillary, the policy wonk, leaned heavily toward hard evidence, too. And because she didn't want to expose herself to unscripted interactions with voters, she wasn't getting much retail political information. From the very beginning of the campaign, Hillary had met with pre-selected groups, but tried to avoid chance encounters with voters who might heckle her. She took the same approach to members of the media, who sometimes relayed the concerns of voters to candidates. She was running a variation on a Rose Garden strategy, the term for an incumbent president who stays at home and uses the trappings of the office to campaign, rather than getting out on the hustings. For years, she'd been in the bubble of elite circles in Washington, New York, and foreign capitals. Whether or not she understood their concerns, she was literally out of touch with voters. Bill hungered for and sought more casual discussions with them. He felt like they weren't talking to and hearing from actual people at events, one of Bill's confidants said. As they began to plot in earnest for the general election, Hillary and her aides thought things were finally starting to go their way. They believed Trump offered them the perfect foil against which to run a base-focused campaign with a dash of outreach to centrist Republicans, fearful that he would be intemperate in an international crisis. Trump was dividing the Republican establishment from its base in the primary, and the Clinton campaign saw an opportunity to take advantage of that rift. If everything went right, and they thought there was a good chance of that happening, Hillary would be able to expand Democrats' dominance of the electoral map. They couldn't or wouldn't see that Trump had spent the primaries courting voters in their backyard. In a traditional campaign environment, Mook's plan to reach into more Republican states made sense not just as a means for giving Hillary the most chances to win, or even a possible mandate with a sizable Electoral College victory, but because it would force Trump to play defense in places where the Clinton campaign could get more bang for the buck. Every day you make Trump go to Arizona, he liked to say, is a day he can't be someplace else. What you're always trying to do is to spend 15 cents if someone else has to spend 75 cents, one source familiar with Mook's thinking said. The problem is we're dealing with a non-conventional campaign. But it was Trump who figured out how to compete without spending as much as Hillary. It would be some time before Hillary, Mook, and the rest of Clinton world discovered that Trump's ability to run a campaign on the cheap was a sign that he didn't have to run everywhere. They already knew that he could rely on earned media, his mastery of Twitter and his ability to orchestrate free coverage from television, digital, and print outlets to carry his message. They knew he didn't need to invest in field organizing programs in the primaries or raise much money from donors to sustain himself. What they didn't fully grasp is that Trump had tapped into a vein in the electorate